Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of Displacement Urbanism. Our episode today is titled Practices and Politics of Data Collection for Urban Displacement. I am pleased to be joined by Ida Selina Lien, who is Chief Technical Officer at UrbanAid. She is an urban economist with a MSc in City Design from the London School of Economics. Her focus is on urban market systems and how urban analysis and programming can link vulnerable groups to markets and jobs in complex and humanitarian settings. She has previously worked for UN Habitat in Afghanistan and Rodeo Architects in Oslo, Norway. We are also joined today by Sinna Berbi, who is Chief Executive Officer at UrbanAid. She is an urban development professional specialized in urban analysis and planning with rapid urban growth, migration affected cities, urban poverty, the relationship between formal and informal cities, and urban crisis response as focus areas. She has more than 10 years of experience, including her role as a program planning advisor at UN Habitat in Lebanon between 2013 and 2017. Welcome to the podcast, both of you.
Very pleased to be here.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I wanted to start today's podcast with talking about some things that you have had a lot of experience with. So one of the things that I'm often struck with when I talk to many people who are engaged in both practice and research on humanitarian crises is a lack of data in contexts that are impacted by humanitarian crises. Just to start off the conversation, what has been your experience with the scarcity of data in urban contexts that have been impacted by displacement?
If we can talk about the experience from Lebanon, firstly, the lack of data in a city, it's not necessarily that it's more acute than in a rural setting, but when a crisis happens, it may affect certain parts of the cities, or you may have displacement that is spread across the city, yet concentrated in certain areas still. So you could have an overlap of increased population that needs services. At the same time, you might have disruption or limited functionality of service provision, housing access, livelihoods, etc., that may have great spatial variations. And that's where the data needs comes in. And moreover, on one side, there is a need for rapid data on humanitarian needs. So you need those kind of rapid diagnostics to inform the quick response. At the same time, the urban crises are usually protracted, meaning that good recovery also means that there is a need to initiate planning for system strengthening as early as possible to avoid repetitive and costly aid provision, where more people will gain from invested money over time if, for instance, infrastructure systems are repaired, enhanced as early as possible in the response. And Lebanon was a good example of that, where you had repetitive water trucking, for instance, instead of repairing infrastructure early on. And the crisis often means that you already, from the very early stages, you have a permanent altercation of where people live. So if you don't have good data, it means that you, both for humanitarian organizations and for local authorities, you don't have the accurate population number to plan your services. It's a big difference if you're planning your infrastructure for a certain number of people and it's actually doubled. So to have good data and quality analysis as early as possible, it means something because the crisis is going to be protracted.
Another aspect of the Lebanon example is that it's a country where you have had overlapping and compounding crises. So after the crisis broke out in Syria in 2011, I mean, Cindy, you can speak to this a lot more, having been there under these years, but it was a critical time where the UN system set up their response, which means that for 13 years almost now, there has been a vast number of actors on the ground in Beirut and in Lebanon. So in this fairly or relatively small city, there's been a very big range of different actors. And with each consecutive crisis situation, you've had an influx of actors, and all these actors need data. All these actors are looking for information on the situation. So some have been there over time and might understand the context better, and some are new to the situation and need to understand everything from scratch, more or less. So you have this information need that's very varied, but you also have had very many organizations over time collecting data. So you also have a history of data and you have a vast amount. So one issue often is also accessing that data, finding the information that already exists. So it's not necessarily only that you don't have data, but it's the access to that data.
What are the different kinds of data that is collected and to what end? Maybe you can also tell us about who is collecting this data.
So there's quite a wide range of type of urban diagnostics, urban profiling, broader analysis to quick updates on situations as they evolve. Some of this data is collected by the humanitarian organizations and may collect survey-based sectoral needs, for instance, or location of displaced people, early impact surveys on natural or man-made crisis. And then you have the evolvement from those kind of quick diagnostics towards more in-depth profiling that also looks to shed light on, as I mentioned, the functionality, how that interlinks with pre-existing challenges or socioeconomic vulnerabilities in the city, tries to understand local governance, their ability to provide services, etc. And those different types of products, if you will, the more in-depth analysis is often done in partnership with local authorities, using the data available and then building onto that. While the quicker analysis may be done either on the larger city scale by humanitarian organizations or even down to a neighborhood level, if you have X organization that are planning intervention in a specific area, they might do a quicker survey to inform their targeting. So it really depends the purpose of the data collection. And then you could sometimes, of course, you do get a bit of an overlap of data collection. And that's where there has been efforts to streamline profiling products or diagnostics products and engaging the different known urban response stakeholders, at least in exercises to develop shared methodologies. But it really needs to be contextualized regardless of how agreed upon methodologies you have, because it really depends on what kind of urban landscape are you talking about? What is the pre-existing data you have within the humanitarian system or with the local authorities? And then down to what kind of data needs do you have for the response in planning? And that also kind of structures a little bit how the different actors may engage in common exercises to collect that data and do the analysis, or if it becomes very much different agencies collect different data on specific areas and or the city level.
The last point there also ties in with what kind of data the actor is looking for. So beyond the joint assessments, as certain organizations might be looking for very specific data depending on their mandate and the type of work that they're doing. So that's also one issue or one challenge when you're trying to streamline data collection efforts, that you cannot necessarily cover everything in one data collection exercise, or if you try to cover too many things, you're also exhausting potentially the person who's giving you the information. So someone who is being surveyed and asked too many questions might be fatigued, or there might be a limit to how much information you can get. So there's also that balance in how you design the surveys or the questions or the data collection itself, and being mindful that it might not answer everyone's data needs, depending on what they're actually going to use the data for. And another point I just wanted to raise, when we were working in Beirut after the explosion in the port, what we saw was that almost all the focus was on the physically damaged areas of the city. So the areas where the buildings had been damaged or destroyed. But the impact of the blast was wide ranging. So, I mean, people across the city was impacted, and even across the nation, being the capital city of the country. So that has also consequences for the type of solutions that one is designing, or the types of response that is being engaged with. So if you're only focusing on certain areas, the solutions or the response will most likely also be focusing on those areas, but you're missing out on some of the wider understanding of how the systems of a city has been impacted, or how that needs to be also strengthened.
So in some of the work we have done for UN Habitat and supported UN Habitat programming under the umbrella of urban recovery programming and the urban recovery framework that the UN Habitat has developed over the past years, drawing on the experiences from these different locations in the Middle East, it's exactly that. So one thing is the targeting of the immediate response, but then tying that to a whole of city approach, and then tying that to regional and even national implications of urban crisis. And in both Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, etc., the implications of the disruptions to services, but also economic activities in main cities, has repercussions way beyond that city itself. But in Lebanon, it also meant that some of the poorest segments of the population and the physically pockets of urban vulnerabilities and poverty, which is are located outside of the physically impacted areas, were fairly overlooked in the years after the blast. So tying that kind of whole of city approach then with policy level and advocacy at the national level, and really linking neighborhood level interventions and targeting based on different sets of indicators, one being the physical damages, but secondly, the socioeconomic situation, and then towards what is needed of systems and functionality to help the economy regain some sort of stability. In Beirut, again, a good example of this, and in Syria, this was also the case, where I believe the urban recovery framework really helped bringing in some broader planning and linkages between interventions at neighborhood and city level to larger systems, for instance, value chain linkages between urban and rural areas, and seeing, okay, how do we do interventions that help the whole value chain system work? Because people will only have jobs to go to if the whole value chain system works. If they only have, let's say, the shops renovated in downtown area of a city, that doesn't work if the rest of the system is not in place. And I think, I mean, this is really linked to the broader urban development agenda that UN Habitat has had for years. But with an increase of urban crisis, there has been, of course, more and more actors that has been forced to develop better practices in how they respond to urban crisis. And I think the knowledge on what it means in terms of density, in terms of different type of shelter and settlements response, in terms of what it means in education, health, a lot of awareness have been raised on those subjects. But really seeing the cities as systems, and seeing the city systems as linked to the outside, that's where there is a linkage to our overall urban planning systems that we know from other places that is still missing in this recovery phase, so to say, or the kind of where we talk about the nexus and linking humanitarian development and peace work together.
But once a crisis passes, who owns that data? Who has access to that data? So is that data available to other urban actors, researchers, so forth? How is that used after that particular moment of crisis has passed?
That's a really good question. And I think the answer might be that it depends. In an ideal world, that data is shared and it's accessible to everyone. But part of that question is also about acknowledging the political dimension of data. And some data, if we're looking at more technical data or certain types of information on, for example, infrastructure in a city, well, this really depends, but some data might be less non-controversial to share. Other data might be more sensitive or controversial. So that is one layer of why I think some data is not shared as much as other data. And then you have a big machinery of different actors who may not have systems and places where you efficiently can share the information. My personal experience is that it really depends on who you know that can get you the data that you know might be available. So one thing is to know that someone collected the data, but another thing is to actually be able to access it. And that can be at the moment of the response. But as you're asking, I mean, what happens to it after the moment where you needed that information or why it was collected in the first place? And many times it's buried somewhere. And this might be changing a bit with AI and new technology developments. I mean, there is big initiatives within the EU, UN, sorry, and organizations to work together to have better platforms for sharing information, sharing data, to code it, to be able to analyze this quicker, to make it more transparent. But again, coming back to the political aspect of it, it might not only be the technical parts that's stopping the sharing of the data.
There's also to nuance that a little bit. In a situation, a humanitarian response, there will always be an information management cluster or working group that is responsible for collecting all the data that is collected from the response partners. There's a slight difference between then collecting the report or all the reports being gathered in one place and having the data sets readily available for different partners. And then there's a difference between open source data versus data being shared within the humanitarian system. So if it's more contagious data, it might still be shared within the humanitarian system, but it might not be available to everyone from the outside if you search for data on a given context online, right? So I think that distinction is important to remember. And then thirdly, that there is often, as Ida was mentioning earlier, a range of partners responding in a city. But if you take Haiti as an example, it was more than 10,000 organizations responding after the earthquake. A lot of these partners were not part of the humanitarian coordination system. Of course, several hundreds were, but a lot of different partners are not necessarily. So whatever data they are collecting or data needs they have, they are not necessarily part of that kind of coordinated system for sharing and updating data. And then some of the data, again, it really depends on the context. If there is a cluster system that has been rolled out or activated or not. The experience in Lebanon was that in the beginning, we were coordinating information on the cadastral level, which sometimes became quite big when it came to the cities. You had a code assigned to the cadastral, but the cadastral didn't bring out the nuances if you had different kinds of neighborhoods within that cadastre. But then there was an effort from the information management working group to assign specific codes to different neighborhoods and areas so that you could actually log very specific both data and interventions done in different areas. And I think that's important to remember. We don't collect data just for the sake of just having it. We do it to respond, right? So then the data will evolve in an ideal scenario because you're actually doing response in the meantime. So that's why you want to have very accurate data also on the interventions implemented since you collected the data on year X.
So that kind of also raises a couple of other questions. One is the temporal nature of data collection. You know, when should that data be collected? Should it be collected at the start of a crisis? Should it be collected at another time? And also, you know, I think going back to one of the earlier points that was made, what kind of data is being collected? So is it data collected for the whole city, or is it data collected just for emergency response? And then I think one of the things that I wanted to sort of get some clarification on is also you mentioned different actors. And I wanted to talk about the role of the local government. So to what extent is some of this responsibility of local governments, and how much of this is also a capacity issue? You know, in your experience, again, have you come across instances in which that capacity needs to be developed because this is not there?
On the temporality, I think it's an important point, and it comes back to the issue of what type of data you're collecting, what type of analysis. Is it a rapid diagnostic, or is it a more elaborated profiling or analysis on the city? If you take Gaza at the moment, what any humanitarian partner is needing right now is as quick updated data as possible on the acute needs. But that doesn't mean that at the same time or with the months to come, as discussions on recovery picks up, hopefully, that means that you need better and better data to understand the differences of the different zones of Gaza. And that data, that brings us to your next question on local governments. Humanitarian agencies that are not present, they don't know the context best. Those who knows the context best, that's the local governments, the local organizations, the service providers, all of those actors who are already in that location. And to create good solutions, we often need that nuanced understanding of what is the services in this area, what was the service functionality before the crisis, what is the service functionality at the present moment, what is the unique features of this area, what is the population numbers for this area, what is their livelihoods, what is the educational needs, what's the health needs, and so forth. So developing that more robust analysis of a location, it requires as much engagement and involvement with local authorities and service providers, etc., as possible. So when we talk about urban profiling, like city profiling, which UN Habitat has been developing a lot of in the Middle East region over the past years, that is analysis that takes time, because you develop that with the local stakeholders to have analysis and data that will help those local stakeholders also do their planning and prioritization over time, right? And sometimes maybe you need rapid profiling, for instance, to inform the humanitarian organizations on let us kind of give you an overall picture of how things are connected in this location. So you don't necessarily need to do a really extensive profiling at the beginning, at the outset of a crisis, just for the sake of doing it. It might help actors that should respond quickly to understand the context they are entering in if they have a more rapid diagnostics. And then you elaborate that, and really those more elaborated profiles that UN Habitat has developed, especially often in partnerships with other actors such as GIPS or local authorities or different organizations. It could also be UNICEF, UNHCR, et cetera, depending on the location, depending who is active there at present. Those profiles often go the extra step of trying to then also set what are the priority actions for this area, often done in conjunction with planning exercises with local authorities, to set priority interventions, to inform donor funding and to say where you will have the most impact of investment, right? So it depends. And then comes, of course, the question on the capacity of local authorities to be involved in that process or take the lead in that process and also own the data afterwards. That's why a lot of these programs are actually set up with a capacity building element from the outset. So you establish a technical office if it's not existing, or you support the technical capacities of the local authorities to manage and also use the data to inform both the kind of technical planning of interventions, but also that kind of whole city approach and thinking.
Just wanted to mention one other aspect of working with local authorities is just understanding the boundaries of the area that you're talking about. So if you're working with one municipality, for example, in Beirut, it's one of very many municipalities that makes up the continuously built up area of the city. So if you are working with local authorities with the data collection, having ways in which you can share, well, set up the data collection, but also share the data between different local authorities might be a very good idea, because isolated, they are not kind of showing you maybe everything you need to know, or each municipality is also very much reliant on understanding the area without outside of its municipal boundaries. Just a quick point I wanted to raise on coming back to technology is I was just thinking about when I was working in Afghanistan, we had a team of GIS officers that worked for 1 year to do remote sensing of all the areas of the country to understand the land use of the country. So you had a very big apparatus to do a mapping exercise, and it took this 1 year. But now you have technology that can do the same thing in a very, very short amount of time. So that means that in an emergency setting, suddenly you have, I mean, the temporality of what kind of data you not only need, but what you can get has changed quite a bit. And that will continue to develop. So it's quite also exciting, I think, for people working within the emergency field, that possibilities of getting access to data is changing rapidly.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of evolvement of, so the methodology for profiling is not just surveys, right? It's a composite methodology where satellite imagery is often used in the early stages to inform rapid changes on the ground. And I think that kind of, again, it speaks to what kind of data you can access quickly, and then reading also patterns over time, how that changes. And that is becoming more and more part of understanding how urban crisis affects an area. And then perhaps particularly in a conflict setting, that is very much needed. And I think we all have seen all of the pictures and satellite imagery analysis that comes out of Gaza, for instance. It provides us, and it doesn't necessarily go through humanitarian agencies to do that analysis, right? It is already available to us to understand how things have changed over the past couple of months. So there is already, you know, like an image repository to start off with if you wanted to do a more in-depth analysis. And then you can also look at the changes of patterns on the ground over time, which is quite interesting.
So one of the things that has often been talked about is also the impact of donors on responses. And I imagine that also works when we look at practices of data collection. So again, when we're looking at different organizations collecting data, to what extent is that also influenced by what the donor's priorities are?
It may depend quite a lot from stakeholder to stakeholder. So you might have certain agencies that are receiving funding from a donor to do core activities within 2-3 sectors where this organization have their mandate, and they collect data based on that. And then, of course, that responds to the priority then set by the donor or that particular agency receives funding to do this type of program, and then another organization receives funding to respond in the same area on different activities, right? So that kind of the more rapid analysis, which is to inform the needs of population within specific areas, it might be driven by quite different priorities based on who these actors receive funding from. Not necessarily a huge problem as long as this is coordinated, so that you don't have a division of areas and then it ends up with one area only covered by, let's say, shelter partners, but the neighboring area is covered only by wash partners. So if as long as there is actually a metrics to ensure that there is coverage and a collaboration to see which households are targeted across different types of needs. But then, of course, when you talk about more on the more lengthier in-depth analysis, it hasn't been historically a huge priority amongst a number of donors, but it's increasingly become something that a selected number of donors are interested to support. But of course, again, you don't need all actors to do lengthy in-depth profiling. You need some actors to collaborate to develop that type of analysis. So I think there has been quite a lot of involvement around that, where some of the larger donors are increasingly interested to see good analysis that can inform a range of different intervention planning across all of the sectors. So it's a little bit on the what services what. In terms of stakeholders and also donor interest and how that steer both profiling and diagnostics, a focus among the humanitarian community trying to inform methodologies for these type of tools is also bringing in a broader set of stakeholders. So, for instance, the Global Alliance for Urban Crisis has also tried to see, okay, what is the role of academics? What is the role of private sector? What is the role of non-traditional donors in this whole urban crisis response and in the development of different tools, and perhaps aligning more with broader urban research and urban development programming that is not just linked to the kind of humanitarian response. There is also quite a few stakeholders that are more and more involved, including philanthropies, individuals that supports research being conducted, studies being conducted on specific urban areas confronted by complex crisis challenges or development challenges. While this is not necessarily already impacting directly how urban diagnostics and profiling is done in the humanitarian sphere, it's of course interesting also to be aware that there are a number of different types of partners that might come in where there's an interest to see their engagement. And it also may include having more access to alternative data that can be used to understand how crisis unfolds and needs. For instance, meta data from Facebook on where people are accessing their social media and so forth. But that comes both with new opportunities, but also, of course, with some caveats on who is providing what kind of support and what are their motives. So there is an interesting kind of evolvement of the spectrum of partners that might be involved in response, and indeed a willingness to engage different types of private sector and foundations as well. Building on, of course, established foundations that has been involved for a long time in humanitarian response, such as the IKEA Foundation, Rockefeller, a range of others. But that is also putting a pressure on the partners to evolve the methodologies and risk analysis on the type of data that is collected as these tools are further developed.
Thank you so much for that. And I think building on that last point, my final question really is sort of in your experience, what you see the impacts have been on the different data collections on beneficiaries and on local authorities as well?
So to start with the process of the data collection itself, we've moved towards really an emphasis on engagement and participatory methods where people are being involved in the decisions that are going to have an impact on their own lives. So that's very positive. But with that engagement, we're also seeing that, of course, it's raising expectations that something will happen. And so you have a responsibility when you're engaging someone in the process to collect information, to manage those expectations. And I think many times the experience is that someone comes in, gets information, and never returns. That's a big problem, I think. So with all this data collection and the information need, there's unfortunately not enough that is being implemented as a result of that. Another point is that my experience, at least, is that a lot of times the data collection and the actual solutions or the what is being implemented aren't always speaking to one another. So you might have data collection tackling very complex challenges and issues, and then you somehow end up with very simple solutions, if I can call it solutions. But let's say you have solar lighting as the answer to a very complex gender-based violence situation in a neighborhood. So you might be tackling issue with something that's not really responding to the issues. And I think that's, again, you have a responsibility when you're doing data collection and you're involving people to actually make sure that whatever you're then doing in response is something that's going to be useful.
I think here another thing that we haven't mentioned is also that sometimes in-depth profiling of a neighborhood, for instance, it's also done to get a comprehensive understanding of how needs are interlinked, how the needs for better infrastructure services might impact, for instance, gender-based violence, or it might impact the health situation, etc. Which is, of course, not necessarily pricing those interconnections, but you do that in-depth analysis to really understand the linkages and also start a conversation on how, as Ida was mentioning, how more comprehensive solutions might solve different challenges that the population face in the same area. But that profiling might not, you don't necessarily do that profiling in all neighborhoods of the city. So it means that you do that in-depth profiling on one area to also inform your understanding of the wider city or even in the country of how the kind of urban challenges manifest itself differently than the rural challenges. Meaning again that you don't necessarily have a targeted budget of a huge envelope for that specific area. And of course that comes, it really links to what Ida was saying on duty of care and safeguarding that needs to come and be in place for that data collection and involvement of local communities and authorities, because the authorities also then are left with a huge amount of data. And you kind of reverse the expectations that now you have all of this data, then suddenly you have the budget to tackle these challenges, which of course might not be the case. So that comes again with that linking the type of data you do to the different levels, but managing expectations and as well ensure that you have initiate a very detailed profiling. It should also come as part of a comprehensive intervention that includes activities on the ground so that the population actually sees some results. And then with capacity building elements and or support to local authorities to take that data onwards to use that over time.
Well, thank you both. This was a really interesting conversation. And, you know, that question of data is so important in terms of how it's collected, who is collecting it, under what circumstances, where, what that data is being used for. I think one of the things that is so important to keep in mind is the political nature of data, which I think you mentioned in this discussion, that data is political, it's power. And so much is at stake in terms of, you know, the kinds of information that we get and we use, we store, we share. And when we look at these crises and the ways in which data is being collected and who's being involved in it, there are so many questions to be asked about what the future of that is as well. So I think this is a really nice way of sort of looking at the issue and sort of highlighting some of the key elements in that. So thank you so much for doing that with us today. It was a really informative conversation and really enjoyable. So thank you so much for your time and joining us on this podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.